This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Just an opening statement. Keep it simple. Just keep it simple. Being a teacher does not require you to be a rocket scientist nor an expert. Nor anything of that nature. It really is talking about simplifying issues. Think about it for a moment. Who were your best teachers? Your best teachers were likely people who could take relatively difficult concepts and make them easy to understand. As teachers, we sometimes refer to it as the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And that actually is the idea, because some people, if they hear me say something about simplify, just keep it simple. But understand it's on the other side of complexity. The most intelligent and the most educated people in the world are people who They've walked through the complexity and they got to the other side and said, you know what, there's really only three principles that govern this. There's three things that make this work, whatever this it is. And if you can get those three down, well, you can make it work. My point here is I'm not telling you that you can avoid the hard work of learning how to be a good teacher. You won't avoid that, but I am telling you, look for simplicity, not for complexity. Complexity normally makes issues difficult to learn. Simplicity makes them easy to learn. And so your job as a teacher is really to take what may appear to be a very complex thing and to simplify it. My wife and I homeschooled for a number of years, which might sound a little weird for a teacher who's been in it for 35 years, but there were some reasons for that, which I won't go into right now. There were good reasons. Got along with my community and at school very well. That wasn't the issue at all. It was just some other issues that were involved. My wife, both of us grew up in the Chambersburg-Shippensburg area, and attended public schools and graduated from public schools. But my wife was quite certain that she would not be able to teach our children to read. I said, Sheila, I think it's easier than what you think. And I remember that when our children began to read, she said, huh, well, there was nothing to that. Not really true. Anybody who has taught somebody to learn to read knows that it's, again, there's a complexity there. But what was her point? Okay, after I actually did it, there's really just a couple of simple things that you do. And that's really what I want to talk to you about this morning is the basics of teaching, or the simple things, the issues that really need to be in place. To help you to be an outstanding teacher. Actually, a better title for this may have been The Habits of Good Teachers would be a way to talk about it. In fact, if you look at the introductory notes, you'll note there, one does not become a renowned teacher overnight. Good teaching habits are learned by hard work and daily application of oneself in the classroom. Good teaching habits go outside the classroom walls and include a wholesome view of the community. So you see there immediately how I'm focusing on the idea of habits. What you actually do day in and day out. You may have heard of the writer Stephen Covey. Stephen Covey was a Mormon. Died here just recently, but you might know him better by the books that he wrote, the seven habits of highly effective people, the seven habits of highly effective families, and so forth and so on. Every one of his books, or most of them, begin with the line, the seven habits. Here's what I found fascinating. At the end of his life, he said, you know, I have gone all over the world and taught literally thousands of seminars from China to Bangladesh to Australia to the United States, all over the world, I have taught the seven habits. Said the most distressing thing to me is that very few people make the transition across the bridge from knowing something about the seven habits to actually making them habitual in their lives. They really are habits. They just naturally, instinctively do them. I said that distresses me. And in some ways, I just begin there by saying to you, what we're really going to be talking about is what the habitual habits of a teacher, what he does, he or she, day in, day out. We heard some of it already this morning. And what I did with this is I gave to you, or I'm suggesting, the quartet of habits. And I draw these, actually, some of this is a little bit of my own. Some of it is drawn from other sources, for whatever it's worth. None of us are very original. We all beg, borrow, and steal from ideas we've picked up at various places and kind of piece them together in various ways. And much of this is that. In fact, the three books that I would suggest to you as a teacher that you probably should read or have, not only read, you should have on your bookshelf. The one that is the oldest is the Seven Laws of Teaching. Okay, and this one is by Gregory. I gave you a handout that lists those seven laws. I am not going to, it's really just a reference page, as I'll explain here in just a moment, but a very good book. That thing was originally written back in the 19th century, in the 1800s. It's been updated a couple of times, but is a very good source. It's not one of those books that you pick up, that you go to bed and lie down in bed and start reading it, and you can't lay the thing down for the next 2 hours. I don't read it that way. There's another time and place probably where you can read the book better. Another one here is a Handbook for Creative Teaching. When I first started teaching in Christian schools, this was kind of the standard bearer. Still a very, very good book. We do not use it here in our basic curriculum, but I'd recommend it to anybody. One of the reasons is because this book, of course, is written pretty much for Mennonite schools. And so it has a better connection with the author here has a better connection with our culture and background and understandings than many of the other authors. A more secular text, but one that is very, very good, First Days of School, is an excellent source. These three are the three that I would put very close to the top, if not at the top, of the list of books that a Christian school teacher should read, have on their shelf as a resource book, and so on. So much of what I have here is cobbled together in some ways from these three books in various ways. Now, the intention here, you have three papers. The one is The Basics of Teaching. It gives a general outline. You have one here, The Seven Laws of Teaching. As I said, that is a summary here. And the other one is just a compilation of teacher proverbs that I have personally gathered together over the years, and I tried to recognize where the quote came from. MBL are my initials, but the rest of them, if they came from a particular source, I tried to point them out. Now, I gave these two to you simply because as we talk here, I'm going to stop periodically and just ask you, look at the teacher proverbs, look at the seven laws of teaching, and tell me how they apply here to what we're talking about. Pick a couple of them out and read them to me. Okay, so you're just using those two as resources or prompts, so to speak, and periodically we'll pull a couple of those up and talk about them. Now, back to the one sheet fronted back here that I have for you today. The quartet, the four areas where you need to develop outstanding habits. as a teacher are highlighted there, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Classroom management, lesson mastery, positive expectations. First Days of School, if you've read that book or had some instruction from it, it's the one that really hammers on those three. And the fourth one is not in that text, but is one that I always add, public relationships. It's not only what happens inside of school that makes a big difference to you as a teacher. It's what happens outside of school. Many a very, very, very good classroom teacher they've fallen on the shoals of very poor public relationships and negated their teaching career simply by what they were doing or not doing outside of school. And so hence, it's a category that I urge you to pay attention to. But we'll talk about it here in a few minutes. So those four I suggest to you as the quartet. There's your basics. Classroom management, lesson mastery, positive expectations, and public relationships. It'll take you a lifetime to learn the details of those four and how they actually work or don't work, and so on. I do want to talk about them a little bit today. I list classroom management first. In my 34 years of teaching, the question I get asked the most often, or the set of questions that I get asked the most often by beginning teachers, almost always has something to do with classroom management. The actual management of what's going on day in and day out. Hence, I put it at the top of the list. And I do that intentionally because number two I have there is lesson mastery. We all have in our minds, if we just knew the algebra better, if we just knew the subject. Well, now don't let me be mistaken on this. It sure helps an awful lot to know what you're talking about. So I'm not trying to negate that, but I'm saying that in most of our Christian schools, there's a little space given for beginning teachers to not to catch up in terms of the content material itself. But if you fail in classroom management on year one, you're forever catching up. That piece has got to be pretty well working for you, or you have no time to study the lesson because you're just busy managing the classroom. There are habits of classroom management. And I should say this as well. Not every habit works well for, not every habit works the same for Sally as they do for Jim. Okay, so when I talk about these, I'm going to talk about them in general ways. We don't have time to go throughout the group here, but and I don't even know you well enough, but I know one thing about you, you have some strengths and you have some weaknesses. And you'll see in the teacher proverbs, I say maximize your strengths and minimize your weaknesses. Okay, so as I talk about these and try to give us some categories in which to think, perhaps you can be thinking, well, where do I do well? The biggest categories are three, which I don't have listed here. They will tell you that all teachers are either student-oriented or they're either student-oriented, style-oriented, or lesson-oriented, subject-oriented, okay? And in my brief years of experience, I found this to be very true. It's good to figure out what kind of person you are. Okay, so when you step into the classroom, what do you care more about, the student or the subject? Now, before you go on a guilt trip, if you happen to care about the subject more than the student, that doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just simply means that you're going to pay a lot of attention there. Okay, it's going to be very important that you come to class every day with your notes written out well, and you know what you're talking about because you're subject-oriented. You want to know the subject. If you're student-oriented, you really, really, really care about the students. The problem with it is sometimes you care so much about them, they never get taught much. in the subject. And there are teachers who are just, they're very student, they care about the student. Style oriented is, I want to do it right. I have my PowerPoint presentation put together, and I have my I want to make sure that I'm dressed properly, and I want to get everything, all the environment just perfect. So I'm paying great attention to the environment. Now, I taught with a teacher one time who was he's a doctor today, but I had him as a student, and then today he's a doctor. But he was style oriented to the nth degree back in those days. Students would enjoy doing this kind of thing. They would, this was in high school, they would take a picture and just tilt it just a tad bit off of being level. And then they would time him to see how long it would be until he saw that picture and that was out of whack and would get it straightened up. Their testimony to this day is, on an average, 3 minutes. He'd step into the, he was such a kind gentleman that he would start teaching, and after a while he would just walk back and to the picture, and he would just kind of that thing oriented straight. He wouldn't say anything. He'd just go back and keep on teaching, but that picture had to be right. He could not teach until that thing was level. while I'm telling a story on him, I have to tell you one more. That I'm not really an organizational genius, but this teacher was. And I remember one Wednesday evening, I was going to church, and the church was right beside the school, and I was supposed to lead singing. Suddenly I remembered, I forgot my pitch pipe. Oh, I thought, I know where there's one. Because this gentleman, if you look, pulled his drawer open, everything was organized just perfectly. You know, I mean, boxes and things just so. So in fact, it was organized so well that I knew exactly where to find that pitch pipe. So I quick ran in the school and pulled the drawer open, and sure enough, right there, front left-hand corner, I pulled the thing out, and I'm often, remember to put that back. Remember. So I go over, and the evening is over, and I come back, and I remembered. Praise the Lord, walked in, put that thing back in there, said gently, shut the drawer, and went home. Came to school the next day. And my dear fellow teacher said, somebody had my pitch pipe. Listen, somebody had your pitch pipe. Now pray tell, how do you know that somebody had your pitch pipe? He said, I always put my pitch pipe in there with the key of F at 12 o'clock. I just threw my hands up in exasperation, said, well, I'm hopeless. I'll never get there. Now, he's a good doctor. Yeah, it was amazing to me. All right, enough of those stories, but you will be oriented. You have a tendency to focus on one of those three. Okay, now here's the thing about it is, you should, since I know that I am subject oriented. Okay, you could do almost anything in this classroom. I mean, turn a picture upside down. I'd never see it probably until this evening sometime. What happened back there? There's a picture upside down. I'd never see that. But I would care an awful lot about whether I had my P's and Q's together in terms of the subject that I was teaching. Okay, if I'm teaching chemistry, I want to make sure I know what I'm doing. The rest of it doesn't matter a whole lot. Well, since I know that, then I have to deliberately pay attention to the areas that I do not, that are not my strengths. So a habit of mine. Is at the end of the day is to go to the back of the classroom and sit down in one of the student seats. I have to do this deliberately. Sit in their seat and look around the classroom and try to get in their frame of mind. What are they seeing? Okay, when I'm teaching, I don't have any feel for that at all, or very little. Hence, I have to actually compensate and make deliberate effort really actually schedule a time and set a time when I think about the aesthetics of the classroom. Sit down, look around. Okay, that's my point to you. So don't get the idea that I think if you have a strength somewhere, well, you can ignore the others. No, it means if you know that, then remember that you will do that style thing naturally. My fellow teacher, he didn't have to deliberately think about pictures on the wall and things like that. That was instinctive. He had to think about other issues deliberately. Okay, now let's come here then to classroom management to talk about it just a little bit. I have a couple of categories here. These are the basics. What are in a classroom? Well, people. And there you see a couple of categories that I point out to you that Stephen already brought to our attention this morning. I thought it was really neat. He's tagging right in on those. The first one there is love. So you're managing people. 30 students, 10, 2, 3. I don't know how many students you may have. But that's one of your first jobs is to be able to manage people reasonably well. that's a skill. That's for sure. It's hardly ever innate. Most people don't have it just naturally in them. It takes a little practice to be able to manage people and manage them well. But remember, some of the things are just very, very simple, like seating arrangements. That's people management. It's also space management, but it's you create a bit of a seating arrangement and you sit students at a particular place for a particular reason. Now, to be very fair with you, the way I always seat students is I do it alphabetically. Start here alphabetically because I don't want them to have even any notion that I set you there because you're a bad girl. We'll just start out the year, but I got my eye open and my ears open and I'm watching. And it's interesting how students will do this. I'm sorry, teachers will do this. If I have a student who is distractive, I put them in the back, not in the front. Why? It's less distracting back there. They'll cause less trouble for the classroom in general. If I set them in the back, then if he's sitting up here and just squirming and fall out, I didn't teach him actually. I had a student in school that he always wanted to. The first grade teacher complained to me, said, "I have no idea. I'll just call him Bob. It's not his real name." So I have no idea with what Bob. Good grief, Bob always looks at the back of the room. He sat right there. In fact, he would twist around so hard he'd fall out of his seat. I never saw anything like it because I watched a couple times. Clandestinely, and this guy would, next thing, plow, he was on the floor. So I said, "Well, sit him in the back. I mean, if he wants to look at the back of the room, just sit him back there, see what's what happens." So she did. And this was the most unusual thing I ever saw. Right behind, not but 3 or 4 feet behind their backs were their clothes, their coat racks and their lunch boxes and things like that. And lo and behold, she set him back there, and I'm kind of watching from, again, clandestinely. And he spent 5 minutes looking at those, looking at the lunch boxes and looking at the coats. Well, it didn't really solve the problem. I forget just exactly how we did come to terms with the gentleman, but the point is classroom management sometimes is as simple as putting people at different places, just managing where they're at, being thoughtful about it. Love. Look in your teacher proverbs and see if you can find a couple of statements there that maybe would talk about that a bit. Or give some categories. Just shout them out.
Number seven,
teaching that impacts is not head to head, but heart to heart. Excellent. Another. 16. The motivators of force and or fear seldom produce a genuine interest in any worthy subject. Good. Yeah, if you got to use force and fear, you're probably not going to get there. Another. 14, a pat on the back, though only a few vertebrae. Removed from a kick in the pants is miles ahead in results. I forgot to give the, that's Howard Hendricks, by the way, who used to say, he's dead now, but a great teacher from years back. Yeah, very good. Another. Twenty-six is the one I like the best. And if there's one that you should underscore in terms of student relationships, it's number 26. If a student knows that you are on his or her side, half the battle is won. I wonder if it's not way more than half. I have seen this repeatedly in the years that I was a principal in Christian day schools. I had teachers who they had degrees, they knew their subject, they were qualified in almost every way except one. And the one was that the students weren't quite sure if they loved, if that teacher loved them or not. And I, to give some content to that term love, I use the terminology, they're on their side. If they know that you will bend over backwards to help them to achieve the goal that you're wanting to see them achieve, I can tell you that you could go a long way. If they suspect that, I say it this way sometimes, if the students know that you love them and that they're on their side, you can make a lot of mistakes and they will forgive you every time. If they suspect that you do not love them for whatever reason, the first mistake you make, pardon the terminology, they'll kill you. it's not really quite that strong, but the fact of the matter is they will get you for the smallest little thing. I have been amazed at this. I've been in schools already that I myself would make stupid blunders or do some ridiculous thing, and the students would kind of just overlook it. Next teacher would come along and do hardly even anything that bad as I would have done, and pow, they got them. And it suddenly occurred to me one day, that's the issue. The issue is the students aren't really quite sure if teacher so-and-so really cares about them or cares or something else that they care about. How's that communicated? The nuances of that are something that every teacher, every personality brings into a classroom. For me, it turns out to be fairness. If students know you're fair, that goes a long ways toward this love issue. I'll never forget, I had three boys two stories here, maybe just to emphasize the nuances of love. The first one is I had three boys who, in 11th grade, they failed literature. Now, I didn't teach them literature. There was another teacher who taught them literature. They failed literature in our school. To graduate, you had to have 4 years of 4 credits in English. And English literature was one of those, and they failed that, so they had to make it up. So I sat them down at the end of the year. This is 11th grade. And I said, gentlemen, let's try to get clear here on something. So you failed literature. We tried to help you through this, and you didn't quite pull it off here. And did the teacher treat you fairly? I wanted to make sure that they understood that they really had failed it. That wasn't somebody else's. And they said, we just goofed off. Okay. I said, all right, now you know that you have to have 4 years of English in order to graduate from Anchor Christian School. Yeah, we know that. Well, so I said, so what are you going to do about it? And I don't know. Now I said, okay, I just want to be upfront with you right now. If next year, when you are a senior and it comes to the end of the year and you still have not completed that literature course and gotten a passing grade on it, you will not graduate. Okay? I said, look, I'll do whatever I will bend over backwards to help you, but I will not bend the rules, and based on my own integrity and the integrity of the school, I just want you to know that now a full year ahead of time. okay, yep. So I said, how can I help you? Well, they weren't quite sure. I said, okay, well, supposing that what I do is give you a a correspondence course to do over the summer. And supposing I give you portions of a correspondence course and have you, would that be something you would, oh yeah, that would work. I said, okay, now I've been here, done this before. I know one thing. It'll be August the 15th and you won't have touched this. So I'll do something for you. I'll actually write up a schedule for you. I'll schedule this. I'll tell you, I'll buy the course for you and we'll schedule it. And I'll check with you periodically to see. Long story short, next at the end of that year, those gentlemen had not finished that course. And they did not graduate. You know, all three of them are, they're some of my best friends to this day. It didn't alienate them. Why? Simply because they knew that I had done whatever I could to try to help them to make it there. Now, if I had just bypassed a whole pile of things, had never said a word to them, got to the end of their senior year and said, hey, gentlemen, you know you can't graduate, we'd have probably had a problem. Okay, but it was the clear communication. It was making sure they, and me, and I'm not bragging on myself, I'm just saying this is an example, trying to go out of my way to help them to get there. Those are the kinds of things I'm talking about. Second story I want to tell you that startled me right out of my wits was, now I know we live in a day and age when they don't paddle so much, but back in my early years of teaching, well, some problems we just solved with a 3-foot stick. I don't know if we solved them or not, but we had a youngster in school who was from a foster child. So, of course, you really were not allowed to spank them. This was along about 7th grade, I would say, which I sometimes shudder to think the way we did things back in those days. But at any rate, there's some boys, their classroom problems or whatever, and so I walked in and said, okay, gentlemen, we're going to have an end to this, so here's a couple of ultimatums, and you know, and I laid out about 3 or 4. I don't even remember the issues anymore. Don't remember what they were, but sure enough, don't you know, 3 of them just blundered along and fooled around and tried me out to see if I really would stand behind my word or not, and he was one of them, this foster child was. So I heaved a big sigh and said, gentlemen, I'll meet you in the basement. So I went down the basement, and I spanked the first 2. And then I turned to this foster child, and I said to him, I'll call him again, Sam, not his real name. I said, Sam, you realize I'm not permitted to spank you. And he broke down in tears. And I said, what's the issue here? He said, they called me Brother Melvin there. He said, Brother Melvin, I have a question for you. Why don't you treat me like you treat everybody else? So I said to him, I said, well, Sam, it's not like you don't need a spanking. Lean over that table. And to this day, he says, that was one of the... All he was telling me, if you love me, treat me like you treat other people. And if that means I ought to have a spanking, then give me a spanking. Now, even though it was actually illegal, when I say illegal, I could have got in trouble for it. I did it anyway. And I'm not quite sure, and I'm not saying it was exactly the right thing to do, but I have never forgotten that. Love, how is it felt and experienced? Think about that deeply as you go into the classroom. Need to move on here a little bit. Security. In some ways, Sam, the boy I was talking about, was looking for security. Is there really anybody in this school who will keep me from doing bad things? That's one of the questions he was asking. Now, he didn't voice it that way at all. But security. I'm amazed at this. Now, I went to public schools, and I tell you what, I had some really, really, really good teachers, outstanding teachers. I don't know what your view is of public schools, but this would have been in the late 60s and the early 70s, but they had their issues for sure. But it's not all bad there. I had some really, really, really good teachers. I had some really, really, really poor teachers. the feel that was different in those classrooms was the security issue. In my worst classes, when you walked in that door, the problem was you never knew what was going to happen next. You had no idea. I remember one classroom I was in, they had those old, I don't know if you remember those old heaters that came out from the wall like this and then went down and it blew the heat out from them. It had a little fan in there or whatever. There's, maybe you're not old enough to remember those, but they had those back in those days. And I had a teacher that would put those things up against he had these blackout drapes that he put along. He'd lean from the top of those back against, up against the wall at the top in order to watch movies. Well, I had fellow students who would get in behind those things and smoke, and you would just see that smoke coming out from behind those curtains like it was like a chimney. Now, Mr. Tunison apparently could not smell because he never caught on to those guys. Okay, now that it sounds funny, but you know what? I did not like that class. It was a chemistry class, and I kind of enjoyed it, but I hated that class. And the more the year went on, the more I hated that class, even though I loved science. And I loved chemistry. Why? It's because when I came through the door, I never knew what in the world was going to happen there. Anything could happen. That amounts to insecurity. Okay? It's the predictableness of a classroom. Now, there should be a sense of unpredictability, but that's called excitement. That's when the teacher does something different that he hasn't done ordinarily. But that's not at all what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that students know that even if I don't know if a bomb goes off, the teacher is competent and will know what to do. Now, don't misunderstand me. I don't mean we always know what to do and we're just right there and all that. But I'm just saying there's a certain level of security we bring into the classroom. And if you can do that, that's called good people management. And belonging. Students need to know that they belong. And this is fascinating to me. I bet I taught for 15 years before I caught on to this. That the student that I missed the most often in the classroom was not the student that you would expect. Let me describe the student to you. Female, 14, 15 years old, good student, always had their homework done, very quiet. Very self-possessed in some ways, a few things like that. What you might call just a supermodel student. Never caused me a bit of trouble. Here was the issue. I totally ignored them. Who did I give my attention to? Here's a thing to ask yourself when you're teaching. Who gets my attention in the classroom? Be careful of one thing. You tend to give attention to the troublemaker. Well, that's precisely what he wants. Sorry to call it the troublemaker a he, but gentlemen, lesson to be learned here. Avoid that. Avoid that like the plague. Now give them, here's what I always, when I was a principal, I would tell a teacher who was having trouble with a troubled student, I would say, okay, when you give them attention, you have to give them the kind of the attention that they wish they had never gotten. Okay? So just be aware of that. And it just struck me one day, and I sat down, again, it was after school, and I sat down on my class, my desk, and looked back over, and I said, now, which students in here do I have relationships with? I started naming them off in my head. I got to looking at the list, and I became aware, here are these two or three girls, that if I really were to talk about having a, what you might call a personal relationship with, I really didn't. Well, why not? Well, because they were in this particular class, they didn't demand my attention, so I didn't. I never really asked them if they felt like they belonged to the classroom or not, but I bet you a nickel if I talked to them sometime, they would say, yeah, you know, we weren't sure what to make of you. So just be aware of that. Belonging is a very important issue. I need to move faster here. I can see that. Time. Okay, classroom management, you manage people, you manage time. Set priorities. What do I mean by that? The trouble with my life, at least, is not that I am so highly tempted to do bad things. Now, I'm not Mr. Perfect. Don't misunderstand me. It's not that that's my bigger issue. Is there's about 85 things that I really would like to do, and I really enjoy doing. But the problem is, and they're good things, I think, for the most part. But the problem is I don't have enough time in the day to do 85 things. I have to sort through the 85 good things and decide probably on the three things that need to be at the very, very top of that list. Okay? As a teacher, you will have that problem. There's a million things that should be done in the class that ought to be done. But the question is, what are the five most important things that need to happen and should happen and you're going to make happen? Prioritize. That's a lesson of life. It's a lesson for the classroom teacher. Schedule, personal, corporate, I think in your handout, I have a statement there. And it looks like I'm going to run out of time if I just don't move along here. But it goes something like this. Number 10, to be sure an event will happen, schedule it. Okay? Now, principles of teaching, which I used to teach here, I do in the fall, but I don't during the summer. I'd always hammer on this one a good bit. So you're a first-year teacher, tell you what to do. Go find the master calendar, whatever it is. If your school don't have one, ask somebody to make one. Should have one, a master calendar that says how things are supposed to work. Every year at the beginning of the year, that's how I start. I lay that calendar down there. Now I take a look at it. I see what the schedules are. I get my plan book out or whatever I'm using to do my planner, and I start down through it because I fill in the pieces that have already been filled in. They're already scheduled. There's a field trip here. There's this. The school program is such and such. I put that right along the right-hand column so I can see that at a glance. That stuff's there. I think to myself, do I have a field trip that I want to do? I want to tell you something. Field trips that are planned 3 days ahead are not good field trips. Generally not. I'm not saying they never are, but seldom are. Plan that at the beginning of the year if you can. When I say plan it, it doesn't mean you can't cancel it. Maybe you do have to cancel it. But far better to actually fill that in somewhere. You know, that would fit the best probably in February. Choose a week, put it in there. Let everybody else know in the school that that's when you want to do that field trip. Okay? Then everybody sees, second and third grade or second grade or whoever's taking a field trip on February 10th. That becomes part of the plan. So, but if you want to make sure that field trip happens, schedule it. Put it in a schedule somewhere. If my wife was here, she would say, her eyes would get big and she'd gasp and she'd say, amen, when did you learn that? Because my problem is I schedule a few too many things along the way. But this one has really stood me in good stead. I am not naturally a good scheduler. Okay? But I have found out if I want something to happen, that's what I need to do. I need to get it on a calendar to say that I will do this. And so on. Do that for even your daily time. What I do is I make a list of things I need to do today, and then that list of things, I take the one that is the most difficult and I push it to the top. And I ask, okay, what time of the day can I actually tackle that one? I plug that one in, and then I protect that time of the day with my life. So if somebody calls me and they want to do something, and I decided I was going to do that immediately after lunch from 1 to 2, and they say, look, can I meet with you after lunch? I'll say, okay, how important is this? Can we meet at 5? Can we meet at 4? Can we meet tomorrow? I don't say, yes, we can meet, and then change my schedule. Now, don't hear that. I hope that's not selfishness nor stubbornness. It's just that I've learned that if you start that shift, now, you don't tell the person, nope, can't meet with you. But you just ask, what's the level of importance here? Can we do this later on in the day or tomorrow or whatever? Because in priority, here's something I know that needs to happen. And here's where I put it to happen. Okay? I learned to be disciplined in that way reasonably. Adequate rest. I always put this one in here. I tell you what, my first 3 years of teaching were, I loved them, but I don't want to do them again. I worked really hard. I got up at 4 in the morning, and I was married. I had 2 children, and I was determined. For me, I determined that I was not going to do any schoolwork after supper. Okay? So what that meant is get up on the early end of the day. So I'd get up between 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock. Nobody bothered me. You know, I had all the time, not all the time in the world, but I could put undivided attention to what I was doing. And I would do all my preparation then, or most of it, I mean, as much as I could get done, I would do in that slot of time. And then when I came home from school and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever it was, well, then I put the books away. I just, you know, I have, no, I better just not say much about that. Our tendency, I'm looking at some of the, I know this is true, I'm looking at some of the finest young people in our circles. I know that. I've been in our communities long enough to realize that if you're going to be a school teacher, if you're willing, whether you're qualified or not, if you agree to do that, you're some of the elite. Sorry to put that on you there, but that's just the way it is, okay? And I know what that means is you're willing to make sacrifices like you wouldn't believe. And so the fact of the matter is you start actually making sacrifices that work against you and not for you. There's nothing holy about sleeping 3 hours at night and getting up the next day and going to school and trying to make things work, and you can't hardly stand on your own 2 feet. And it all of a sudden struck me one day, there's nothing holy about that at all. Okay? It's far more wholesome and by inference holy to actually get adequate rest. And now anybody that knows me, I'm not talking about laziness. I don't have much time for that. Okay, I'm talking about realizing, though, that I'm far more efficient. For years, I went on 6 hours of sleep a night. Along about 40, I realized that this was catching up to me a little bit. So I upped it to 7. I said, okay, I'm going to get on the average 7 hours of sleep. And that's today, it's somewhere between 6 and 7. Okay, and I'm not that's what I need in order to function reasonably well. If you need 8 hours, then get 8 hours of sleep. If that means skip some things that you maybe would have really liked to have done, but you know that's going to really start to catch up. You know, once or twice, it doesn't hurt. It's the habits that get you, okay? Get adequate rest. Space organized by priority, organized for efficiency, organized for aesthetics. Maybe I'll just say the priority one has really been helpful to me. That one is this. I learned this from somebody else. They told me to go sit down at my desk, put my arms out, go like this. Okay, said, okay, that's space A. Space A is, there should be nothing in space A except what you use every day. So a pencil belongs in space A. Name them, whatever they are, that's in space A. And this guy was really good. He knew my pedigree like you wouldn't believe. He said, I know what you've got, space A. He said, you've got U.S. News and World Report, Time. He wasn't talking to me directly. He was talking to a group. And all of a sudden, man, I said, I need to walk the sawdust trail here. I mean, I'd have some, because I had all kinds of stuff there that I didn't need for what I was doing. And some of it, I didn't use it every day. He said, get that out of space A. Space B is what is within 10 feet. You have to get up and walk to it, but it's in line of sight. That's what you... Nothing should be in there that you do not use at least one time in a month, and better yet, once in a week. Okay? And he said, space C is the area that, you reference that once a year, twice a year, whatever it is. If that stuff is in space A, get it out of there. Put it in space C. That's what I mean by range, by priority. Okay, enough said. You can make your own application. Your materials, assemble ahead of time to use, develop a file system that works. Notice that works. A comment here. What time is this over? Okay, but you're supposed to be at the next workshop at 11:15, right? Mm-hmm. Yep, okay. A comment here on electronic stuff. I use it. The two most powerful, I'm very task-oriented. That is, a new gadget comes out, I don't give a hoot. I don't fool with it, I don't learn it. I'm task-oriented means if I need it to accomplish a purpose, then I will master the skill. The three that I use the most often are Microsoft Word. You ought to learn that like the back of your hand. Microsoft Excel, should use it, learn that as the back of your hand. That's my grade book. I just format an Excel sheet and use it. It works really, really well. And the third one is PowerPoint. And that one, kind of off and on. but I keep telling everybody, the next new piece that comes out, if that's a requirement, I'm retiring. I'm done. I'm probably just joking on that point. But learn. Some of you are probably, I'm not pointing any fingers. I know a couple of you just a little bit, fairly well here. And some of, but most of you I don't know. Do not become an electronic junkie. It'll waste more time and you can shake a stick at. If the thing will work for you and it actually in the end will save you time, then learn it and learn it well so that it actually works for you, not against you. You can apply that however you want. Facebook. you see me saying there, leverage technology to your advantage, not against you. If you sense it's working against you, trash it. Don't use it. Back of your page, lesson mastery. Okay. On your seven laws of teaching, first law is a teacher must know that which he would teach. Well, duh. Of course he does. Now, let me tell you, I don't know how many of you will be teaching in maybe fifth and sixth grade, and you'll be teaching all the subjects. And perhaps it will be individualized. It makes it a little bit easier. Or perhaps it will be conventional. If it's conventional and you have to prepare for five, six different subjects, you're going to have to make some decisions, particularly if it's your first year. Okay? Here are my suggestions. Be successful in at least three subject areas. Now, I say at least three. I would actually reduce that to even at least one. Here's why. If you do one class really well, the students will always be eager about that class. I can't wait till math, or I can't wait till whatever, music, or whatever it is. Well, that's great. You need to have at least one spot in the day like that that students eagerly look forward to. And that's why I'm saying, look, if you have to reduce the amount of preparation and time or mastery that you put into two or three of the courses, well, do that. You can reduce a little bit and get by, but make sure there's at least one spot in the day that students love and they're eager for. If you can up that to two, do it. If you can up it to three, fine. I'll be very surprised your first year if you can do it in all five. It's very, very hard to get that done. I've tried it before. Use a lesson planning rubric that works for you. Lean on good curriculum helps. Listen. First year I taught school, there were no Christian publishers, hardly. Might have been a Becca around, I'm not quite sure, but we thought we were poor, I guess our community thought we were poor, so they bought used textbooks and we had no teacher's manuals at all and we had no tests made up. I used a teacher's text, the student text. So that meant type up everything, and we didn't have computers in those days. I typed things up on with a mechanical typewriter on spirit duplicators and all that kind of stuff. And so my outlines all came, the test, I had to make up all the tests, everything. Now you see why I was up at four. I would never forget about, 4 years into teaching, I had my first computer. It was a Tandy 1000 EX. For those of you who might know a little bit about, that's an old, old, old computer, let me tell you. They didn't autosave or anything like that. And I'm typing along morning, I'm trying to get a test going. Yeah, I'd always make that thing clatter all over the place. My little oldest boy was about 2 years old, and he was crawling around my feet. It's about 7 o'clock in the morning. You know those little power strips that have those little buttons on? Pow! Everything went dark. Oh, my. Of course, he wasn't to blame. I had to get up from my desk and take a little walk. On that one. Now, that was a little odd. Anyway, my point is you have a lot of tools in your hands today that weren't around originally. There is nothing wrong with leaning on those. If there are lesson outlines already made, use them. Now look, lessons are always better when they become personally the teachers. But remember, I'm saying do well in one subject. If there's some other ones that you're going to have to back burner a little bit, well, rely on the stuff that's already prepared, already done by the curriculum writers. Get it out and use it. That doesn't make you a poor teacher. That makes you a smart teacher. I use what's there. and learn how to cut the corners and so forth. That's my point there. Don't get discouraged. Tomorrow it will go better. And next year even better. But I don't know if this will discourage you or not. It wasn't until my third year that I really, really began to feel comfortable about things. Or reasonably comfortable. First 2 years was hard work and just on the edge all the time. Third year, I started to sort of get my footing. And probably about the fifth year that I really felt right, you know, to walk into the classroom and keep going. Some of you may not teach that long, but don't get discouraged. Keep at it. Positive expectations is the third one that First Days of School gives. And I just have a couple of comments there. By positive expectations, they mean, I think I have there in the second one, create a can-do atmosphere. We can do this. Okay. Personally and as a group. It can be done. Now, look at the first one there that I suggest, though. Positive expectations are achievable expectations. Sometimes we get carried away with our positive expectations and we get them so high and lofty that the first thing you know that you can't get there. Well, make them something that you can achieve and then work that direction. But always, even in classroom management, this is very, very important. I learned this somewhere early on in my teaching that rather, if I'm going to go out of the classroom and go somewhere else, yeah, rather than say, okay, now you better behave, or when I come back, if you don't, somebody is going to be in hot water. I just walk out the door like as if I assume they'll behave. And if I come back in and they're not behaving, I say, what's going on? What's happening here? Like, well, I never expected this. It is amazing if you expect something strongly enough, it's more likely to happen. That way, so positive expectations, you know, expect the best and work for the best. Be reasonable about it. This goes a long, long, long ways. Upbeat teachers. Just think about the teachers you've had. The ones who are kind of down in life, you struggle with a bit. At least I did. And it doesn't mean you're up there doing a song and a dance, standing on your head, or things like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about being a person, a can-do person. Yeah, we can do this. Get out your books, turn to page 300. We're gonna look at these ideas in science or whatever, and at the end of the period, we're going to do this little experiment, put off a model rocket or whatever it is. Yeah, we can do this. And then proceed to do it. Communicate personally with the students. Here's the thing. The point I'm making here is I found myself, I think, being rather positive in a general way. Okay, so here are these 20 students I have, and I'm building positive expectations, so I come into the classroom and hep it up a little bit and have my heart at the right place and enjoying life and all of that. But sometimes Sally just needs, as she's going out the door, Sally, I really appreciated such and such and such and such. That was great. Okay, Sally needs to hear that personally. Okay, not just a corporate statement. I found that to be really, really, really important. And if you're like me, since I'm not a person who naturally does that kind of stuff, I have to pay attention. Pay attention. I'm sorry to make it this scientific, but I actually have a roster of my students, you know, now and then, sit down and look at that roster and say, man, when was the last time that I actually personally, just in a personal conversation, had even a sentence with Sally? Okay, and if I haven't, mentally note, tomorrow, I'm going to make sure maybe just on the ball field, just kind of sidle over and say something, you know, Sally, how's it going? Hey, I heard that your dad, whatever, you know, bought a new truck had some personal communication there and personally, positively upbeat about it. Go out of your way to do that. It'll pay you in very, very, very rich dividends. And finally here, public relationships outside of school. Pay attention here. Again, I've known teachers who have done well with classroom management, or reasonably well, fairly well with lesson mastery and fairly well with positive expectations, but oh my goodness, they weren't getting along with the people who had something to do with the school, the people, whether it was a board or whoever it was, they were struggling there. And first thing you know, they, in fact, I'm thinking of a man, a personal friend of mine, taught school for 13 years, and just this year he said, you know, I'm done. He said, Brother Melvin, I'm just done with it. I said, well, why are you done with it? He said, I'm just fed up to, you know, last year it was just round and round and round with the board. And I you know, they don't seem to appreciate me, and I'm just done. Well, I'm not faulting him. I don't really know the details there. But it amazed me that here is a man who is really a pretty good teacher and has been teaching for a period of time, and it was nothing in the school itself that has pushed him to quit teaching. Actually, it's things happening outside of the school that he's gotten tired of. So pay attention here. Parents, board, faculty, underscore faculty, particularly those of you who are fairly young teachers, pay attention to building good faculty relationships. If you have an issue with what the principal's doing, if you have a principal, go talk to them and find out what the deal is. You know, my boys, we moved up here from Chambersburg back in 1990. Well, we've up here in 93 and then came back up, went home for a year, came back up in 95, and then two of my boys went back down, taught school there, and I gave them strict orders right from when they left home to go down there. I said, now, gentlemen, you're not going down to fix the school at Chambersburg. You know that? That's not your job. In fact, if you hear anything I've said to you as your dad, go out of your way to fit into that community and to enjoy the board and to enjoy the board chairman and the church, and don't go down there and try to create waves. It's precisely the wrong thing to do. Rather, create good atmospheres around you. And I just would say that local fellowships there, church leaders. And I know you ladies are probably not going to do this. You're probably not going to call up the local bishop and say, "Look, you know, could I have breakfast with you or something like that?" don't blame you. I understand 100%. But there probably are key individuals in the community, maybe ladies, that are really well respected. Well, make some connections here, particularly if you're teaching outside of your community, where people don't really know you. If that's the case, I would go out of my way to create connections in the community outside of the school that really provide infrastructure for you and what you're doing. I urge you to do that. Peers. Some of you appear here to be maybe, 19, 20, 21 years old, and some of you older, I suppose, but been around long enough to see how this works. So you go into another community, you relate to your peers differently than what you do those older ladies or those older men in the community. And I often have found some of the bigger trouble created with the peers in a community, particularly for young teachers, than with board or whatever. So pay attention there. Church responsibilities, neighbors. Okay. 1 minute, your questions. While you're thinking, remember, I'm trying to emphasize habits. Okay. What do you do habitually? And you want to create, I think I have in those teacher proverbs there, habit and structure. Create the kind of atmosphere. And if you happen to be a person who doesn't enjoy habit and structure, okay, I understand that, respect it. Just remember, it works for you. And routines. Now, I spouted off there for about an hour about basics that I know a little bit about. Yes, sir. His motivational quotient is more important than his intelligence quotient. yeah. Good question. Other questions? Well, there's some material there to look over. And here's I have an assignment for you. After you're into teaching for 1 month. So in September, I don't have my calendar here. Yes, I do. You don't need to write this down. Commit it to memory. Friday, September, September the 27th. put these three papers somewhere, not because they're so important, because I did them. Pull these three papers out and read over them. And give some thought as to the categories, the habits that you need to do something about or whatever. And periodically, just pull some of this. I kept it deliberately simple, three sheets. But one sheet so that it would only take you just a few minutes to glance over them, okay? Sometimes we need refreshed. That's your assignment. September, what did I tell you? Already forgot, 27th. If I had a way to check on you, I would. It's called accountability. Thank you very much. Going to have to let you go so you can move along to your next assignment. I want you to know that I am deeply, deeply appreciative and respectful toward young folks who have taken up the responsibility of teaching in our classrooms. And it's a very, very important, very difficult. And God bless you as you step into the classroom and go at it. Remember the basics. God bless. You're dismissed.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.